This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
Fill in the blank. If something's not transitory, it's what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdell. It is Wednesday, today the 12th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let's take a spin through a thesaurus as a way to get going today, shall we? Synonyms for persistent, as in persistent inflation. You could call it stubborn, tenacious, unrelenting, relentless. I think you get the idea. Our interest in vocabulary today comes from this morning's report on the Producer Price Index, the PPI. That is, of course, inflation at the wholesale level. Up more than expected, 0.4% August to September, 8.5% higher than a year ago. See also persistent, stubborn, tenacious. I'll stop there. Anyway, with an eye toward tomorrow's report on consumer inflation, that is the CPI, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour takes a look at where we're at.
Inflation for the people who make the things we buy, producers, shot up in September. Compared to the year before, prices were up 8.5%. That's an improvement over August and July and June, but it is an ugly number, plain and simple.
We're not out of the woods yet as it relates to price pressures.
John Lear is chief economist with Morning Consult.
Clearly, producers are continuing to experience elevated price growth, and I would expect that to continue to sort of impact consumer inflation going forward.
The big drivers for producers were food and especially services.
A lot of that is being driven by elevated labor costs. That is a function of the tight labor market.
That, of course, strikes at the heart of what is so dangerous about this economic moment. To ease inflation, the labor market probably needs to slow down, and a slowing labor market can very quickly look like recession. Still, producer prices are different from consumer prices, and for tomorrow's consumer price index, there are signs that inflation could be fading. Take, for example, used cars.
Used cars led the inflation on the way up. They are likely to lead the inflation on the way down.
That's Alan Detmeister, economist at UBS. He says wholesale used car prices have declined nearly 8% in 11 weeks. Apparel prices may be on the verge of falling significantly too, says Omer Sharif with Inflation Insights.
You're reading a lot more about apparel being discounted heavily at, you know, Walmart, Target, Kohl's. So everyone is trying to move inventory.
Sharif says that when you look at month-to-month changes, tomorrow may finally bring some good inflation news.
I basically think tomorrow is going to be the start of a string of much lower core inflation readings of the type that the Fed has been waiting to see all year.
Now, that does leave out food and energy, and we do need to travel, and we do need to eat. Those two items are notoriously volatile and hard to forecast. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time. We get the CPI on Wall Street today. Oh, so close to flat. But down at the bell, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so now an industry where what the Federal Reserve is doing to get inflation under control is really changing things. The average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage has more than doubled this year, and that, of course, is playing out across real estate. So we've gotten Vivian Geller on the phone. She's the CFO at Pacific Trust Group. That's a mortgage lender here in Los Angeles. Vivian, great to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai. Nice to be here again.
Okay, so we had you on in April when the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage average was 5.1-ish%. And you said then that business for you had come to a screeching halt. And one can only wonder what life is like now in the mortgage business with rates at like almost 7.
Oh, Kai, yeah. If you can believe it, it's actually gotten worse. It's pretty quiet right now. We're seeing a little bit of activity with like previous first-time buyers who were bidding on, you know, multiple homes last year and that are just starting to dip their toes back in. But overall, it's really quiet.
Are you surprised at all that housing prices are not coming down as rates have gone up?
I'm surprised they're not coming down extensively, but they're coming down a little bit. We're starting to see them right now. We're starting to see price cuts across the board at all price points. But yeah, relative to the interest rate, I would have thought that they'd come down even further at this point, especially with the stock market also where it's at. And that's not helping, but hasn't really affected the housing prices as much as I would have thought it would have.
Yeah, when you talk to your colleagues, either in, you know, the sort of the real estate business writ large or specifically in mortgage, what's the mood?
It's pretty doom and gloom. I mean, we just have there's been another huge wholesale lender, Finance of America, that announced closure this week. That coupled with a couple of other biggies. We're starting to see, again, more layoffs, you know, with the lenders across the board. Yeah. It's not pretty.
It's important to note here, it's not like nobody's buying houses. I mean, you do have a little bit of business going on.
Yeah, there's still activity. And like I said, there's some first-time buyers coming back around. They were priced out last year. They're able to negotiate. They're getting seller credits to buy homes. So there's still stuff going on. And, you know, a lot of investors having to think quick and, you know, refinance the properties that aren't selling. There's still activity. It's just very quiet.
What's sort of the risk appetite, right? I mean, you're making riskier loans or are you still trying to be safe? What are you doing?
Everyone's doing ARMs at this point at the higher price
adjustable
points.
Adjustable rate mortgages, yeah.
Yeah, everyone's doing adjustable rate mortgages because the rates are much lower. Smaller price points, they're still doing 30-year fixed. But at a higher price point, people are taking that risk. And we're seeing people jump in, too, that know that next year they're going to refinance in about a year. So,
Okay, so this is none of my business, but when you get up in the morning and you have a cup of coffee and you brush your teeth and you work out or do whatever you do, then do you like go to the office or do you jump on the phone? I mean, what do you do in an environment where it's so slow?
Well, it's funny you ask because I work out a little longer and I take my time to get here. But, you know, on one level, yes, it's nice to have the time, but, you know, you do worry and you think about, is there a future in this for me? But it goes up and down and things will get better. That's just the nature of the market, really. You have to save your beans when you have them.
Yes, you do. You just got to save your beans. How long have you been doing this? 20-something years, right?
Over 20 years, yeah.
Okay, so do a compare and contrast between 2008 and the financial crisis and today.
Well, definitely slower right now than 2008.
Really?
In 2008, we saw the housing prices come down, so there was activity then because people were actually going back into the market and buying, you know, there were fire sales. But right now, you've got high interest rates, you still have relatively high prices, and you have a stock market that's, you know, tanked. So not good.
All right. So you're the expert on this call about real estate and mortgages. How long till things pick up again for you?
I would say maybe end of second quarter 2023. The Reserve has said that they were going to increase rates through then, maybe second quarter. Mm-hmm. And they're doing what they said they were going to do. So we kind of have to believe them.
Vivian Geller, she's at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles. Vivian, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. Talk to you soon.
Uber and Lyft and DoorDash are probably three of the best-known gig economy companies out there. And shares of all three of them had a really rough ride yesterday after the Biden administration announced a new proposed rule that might wind up with millions of Americans, think rideshare and delivery drivers, of course, among them, but many others, being classified as workers and not independent contractors. There is lots of bureaucracy to go before anything actually happens, but it's the first real federal move into this kind of regulation that until now has mostly been done by the states. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more on that one.
Washington should be involved in setting standards for how gig workers are classified, says Cornell's Patricia Campos Medina, because up until now,
they have failed to keep up with the regulations that are needed to meet the changes in the economy.
She says the rules for gig companies have been largely set by cities and states. Take California. It's resorted to a patchwork of legislation, court rulings, even a referendum to regulate how the industry classifies workers. Campos Medina says having the federal government take initiative matters.
It raises the standards for everybody, for every worker.
In a way that many labor activists say is long overdue. On other issues, too, like raising the federal minimum wage, which Congress hasn't done in more than a decade. Kristen Sharp is the CEO of Flex, a rideshare and delivery company trade group currently reviewing the government's approach to redefining the status of workers.
We're cautiously optimistic that the proposed rule, if enacted as is, which may or may not be the case, wouldn't result in significant impact to our member companies' operations.
Companies like Uber and Lyft have said reclassifying drivers as workers would require them to change their business models because of rising labor costs from new worker benefits and protections. Any change wouldn't just affect workers at gig companies, according to UC Hastings' Vina Dubal.
But also in low-wage sectors that are primarily occupied by immigrants and racial minorities.
Like construction, farm, domestic, and janitorial work. She says the Biden administration's proposal is a start, but doesn't go far enough. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it could be like 4 or 5 days in the studio.
Publishing is not easy. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 28 points today. That's a 10th percent, 29,210. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, down about a 10th percent, 10,417. S&P 500 down 11 points, about a third of 1%, 35.77 there. So could this be a rising tide that lifts all the cruise ships? Norwegian Cruise Lines reported a 17% increase in occupancy in the third quarter. Cruise industry, of course, battered by the pandemic, seems to be banking on the expectation that relaxed COVID testing and vaccine requirements will drive demand. Norwegian's stock jumped around 11%. So did Royal Caribbean's. Carnival down almost 10% today. Moderna saw its stock rise more than 8%. After announcing it's going to partner with Merck to develop and sell a personalized cancer vaccine, Merck slipped about 0.7%. Sabrina was telling us about food prices are generally, you know, high. Fruit costs 20% more than it did last year. Veggies rose a whopping 40%. Bad news for those of us on a plant-based diet, right? What about carnivores? Beef and veal are 23% cheaper than last year. Pork is 2% cheaper. Chicken prices, though, up about 4.5%. Bond prices up as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.90%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It is 2 weeks today that Hurricane Ian slammed into southwest Florida. More than 120 people died in the storm and its aftermath. The economic damage is going to be upward close to probably $100 billion total economic and insured costs altogether. And recovering from it, of course, is going to take years. The team from our podcast, How We Survive, has been working on a whole new season about housing and climate change in South Florida. It officially launches next week, but Climate change doesn't know or care about podcasting publishing schedules. So host Amy Scott went down to Fort Myers to talk to survivors picking up the pieces.
Thomas Eaton rode out the storm at his home in Northport, a small city on the Myakka River.
It was scary. I was watching the waves hit my bedroom window.
Eaton's neighborhood is miles from the coast and was not under an evacuation order. But when Ian came, it sat over Northport, dumping more than 20 inches of rain over 3 days. Eaton says floodwaters rose to about 4.5 feet inside his house.
The water was coming through the walls. I thought I was going to see Jesus, man. I just laid on my bed and watched out the window and just watched it all.
I met Eaton at a temporary shelter up the road from Northport at Venice High School. Inside the gym, about 100 air mattresses are spread out across the floor. An elderly man in American flag shorts rests on one of them as a woman gently washes his feet. The shelter is operated by the county school district. Jody Smith is a social worker with the district. Instead of counseling students, on this day, she's helping storm victims.
Right now, we're just focusing on keeping families safe and fed. If they need a shoulder, we're a shoulder. If they need a blanket, we get them a blanket.
Do you need spoons?
Oh, my God, Ben and Jerry.
Hey, sir, do you want a spoon?
An afternoon ice cream delivery brings a welcome distraction from the trauma.
And make sure it's chocolate.
When Ian hit, Passion Presley and her daughter, Ronisha Taylor, spent a terrifying night at home as the winds of more than 100 miles per hour pounded their windows.
Oh, we were praying.
I feel like Dorothy on the Wizard of Oz.
The adults took turns bracing the doors with their bodies while the kids sheltered in a closet.
Were they scared?
Yeah, they were scared. Yeah. They were scared.
The family of seven made it through the night, but then couldn't escape the floodwaters. For almost a week, they were stuck in their house without power or internet access, until finally a pair of airboats came to rescue them.
It looked like a swamp with houses and like on top of the water.
And they're still recovering bodies.
And then the road is completely closed, and we don't know when we'll be able to even check the house to make sure we don't have any damages inside.
So they wait. Presley says T-Mobile donated some phones so people could call family members and insurance companies. I met 72-year-old Nina Migliaccio standing outside the gym holding a little black and white dog with a pink leash.
This is Candy, 6 years old, Chihuahua.
Migliaccio and her husband Carl had been in the shelter almost a week. The Red Cross had finally arrived that day, and Migliaccio was eager to get medical help. She was almost out of her medicine.
We need doctor attention. My husband disabled, and myself, I have leukemia.
Given all she'd been through, Migliaccio looks remarkably put together in a clean striped shirt and cargo pants with silver sandals. Turns out these are the clothes she evacuated in. She's been washing them in the shower, then wearing them in the sun to dry out. She wasn't sure when they'd be able to return home. Big chunks of the roof were missing, and she wasn't sure how much their insurance would cover.
We cannot go back. You must have a roof.
You must have a roof. Though she'd been able to rescue Candy, they'd had to leave behind their African gray parrot, Rocky.
I worry because, you know, over 1 week, he was without water.
So the next day, I drive to Northport to see if I can check on Rocky. The water has receded on Migliaccio's street, but evidence of the damage is everywhere.
Man, it's really something. You can see big pieces of the roof blown off. There's just debris strewn all through the yard. A blue, maybe propane tank. Mangled pieces of roof and gutters.
I walk around back, past the small swimming pool filled with black water, and peek inside, where a large birdcage sits empty. I give Nina Migliaccio a call. She says the cage is empty because someone came by with the police to rescue Rocky.
This lady come from Sarasota and Beckham.
Well, that's good. I'm glad he's in good hands.
Yes, yes, yes.
Migliaccio says she and her fellow evacuees have been told they'll be moving from the high school to a recently closed hospital in Venice, where she's looking forward to having a private room. When I look around her neighborhood, it's clear it's going to be a while before she and Carl can come home. The rebuilding process has only just begun. We'll have that story tomorrow. In Northport, Florida, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Tomorrow at 1 Eastern Time, Chairman Benny Thompson is going to gavel the January 6th committee hearing into session for what is probably, but we don't really know, going to be its last public hearing. Also unknown is when the committee is going to release its final report. But when it does, be glad you're not in the publishing business, because it is going to be a madhouse. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explores the business of publishing public records.
The day the House releases the January 6th report will be a very busy one for book publishers. Sean Desmond is the publisher and vice president at 12 Books.
There will be this like fire drill period where the report does drop in the morning. We grab the file off of PubGov or somewhere, wherever the committee is housing it. And then it's a race.
A race to reconfigure the report into a book, a race to print copies and get them on booksellers' shelves or to Amazon warehouses, and a race to finish the audiobook.
It could be like 4 or 5 days in the studio, morning, noon, and night. It could be upwards of 50 to 60 hours.
And it's all a race because the content of every publisher's version, there are at least 4 going to print, they'll all basically be the same. A cleaned up copy of the report with some context from a writer. 12 Books is working with the New York Times to add analysis and visuals by the paper's staff.
The report itself is a free document, and that's why 12 and the New York Times are trying to bring value to the reporting and offer readers something that's special.
You might be wondering what the audience for something like this is. Government documents printed, bound, and sold for $19.99. People's love for these reports go back to 1964 and the Warren Commission report on the assassination of President Kennedy. Alan Lichtman, a history professor at American University, says it initially sold 1 million copies, and it continues to sell because it's a big piece of American history.
We still debate today who really killed JFK. We still debate today the implications of the 9/11 attacks. And of course, the Mueller report touched on issues of great import to our democracy.
Lichtman says people's interest in these reports shows they're politically engaged. And though the reports are often written as a dry account of events, they're sometimes downright juicy.
The Starr report.
That's the investigation of President Clinton's Whitewater controversy that morphed into examining his relationship with White House intern Monica Lewinsky.
Not only reads like a novel, it reads like a pornographic novel, which may account for some of its interest.
When the Starr report was released in 1998, tens of millions of Americans logged onto their slow dial-up connections to read it. The book became a bestseller. Another publishing hit was the 9/11 Commission Report, which was a nonfiction finalist for the National Book Award. Rachel Deal at Publishers Weekly says even reports that don't sell well make money.
It's low-hanging fruit. These books are very cheap to do. They are public documents, and so they might be free, or you might be sort of paying potentially a small fee if somebody's doing a foreword.
After paying fees to authors and booksellers and spending on marketing and printing, most books in the $15 to $20 range make around a dollar per book for the publisher. But Deal expects the profit margin on published reports to be much bigger. And even when they're not an instant hit, they have a long game.
Backlist books are books that will continue to sell over time. They might be of value to schools and other organizations, you know, who might be putting them on a syllabus or something like that.
Plus, she says there's always an appetite to re-examine the past. For instance, the Mueller report made people look back at Watergate. In other words, history repeats itself. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a little bit more real estate rent this time after that interview with Vivian Geller about the mortgage business. I saw this on Bloomberg, some data from Realtor.com that says the increases in rents in this economy are slowing. Rents are still going up, to be clear, 7.8% August to September, but that is the slowest rate of increase in a year. Also, just because context matters, and I know I say that all the time, median rent in this economy is still up almost 25% from the before times. All right, here is your moment of economic context. It's a very macro moment, to be honest. The Congressional Budget Office said this week that according to its math, the federal deficit, remember that's the annual amount we spend above what we take in as opposed to the national debt, which is all the deficits added together. Anyway, the deficit for the federal fiscal year 2022, which just ended, was $1.4 trillion. If that sounds like a lot, number one, it is. But number two, the FY21 deficit was $2.8 trillion. So, you know, progress. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.